Many thanks to all of you for coming. Perhaps because today is April Fool's Day, or perhaps because a presidential address is both an enormous honor and very intimidating, I decided to rush in and take this occasion to think seriously about the shape of the field in which I work. I work in a field often called applied ethics. It's a very young field. When I started graduate school, it didn't have a name. John Rawls' A Theory of Justice was at the center of normative ethics, if normative ethics really existed at all in the wake of the assaults of the non-cognitivists. And serious philosophers were just beginning in fields like bioethics. The Journal of Social Philosophy and Social Theory and Practice both began in 1970. Philosophy and Public Affairs published its first issue in 71. The Society for Applied Philosophy began in 1982 and started publishing the Journal of Applied Philosophy in 84. The Association for Practical and Professional Ethics is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. Sub or related fields like bioethics or environmental ethics are very young as well. The Comprehensive Bioethics Organization, ASBH, began only as recently as 1998. The journal Bioethics began publishing in 1987, and volume one of Environmental Ethics was actually the earliest in 1979. So, with 25 years or maybe a little more to look back on, I'm going to advance a couple of mild claims. That applied ethics is a misnomer, that it reflects a misguided approach to work in the field, and that we can do better. More specifically, it suggests that there are theoretical paradigms, such as autonomy, big A, that are developed independently. It suggests that theory development is one field, ethics, and theory application is another, applied ethics, maybe practical ethics. I kept trying to think what the opposite of that would be. Impractical? I don't know. The ethical principles are separate from the problems to which they apply. And these principles are then applied to real-world circumstances in top-down fashion. The enterprise is unidirectional. The ethical approaches don't learn from the problems to which they are applied and their context. On this picture, the theoretical paradigms pick out the problems to be addressed, like decisions to withhold or withdraw treatment, treatment of patients who lack decision-making capacity, experimentation with human subjects, protection of confidentiality, and many more like that. Other problems recede to the background, discussed as an afterthought, if at all, like questions of justice in healthcare or what to do in pandemics. I think this picture, this top-down picture, is very, very wrong. So in the first part of my talk, I'm going to sketch out some of the ways I think it goes wrong in more detail. Then I'm going to describe what I hope are some ways we can do better. And to avoid suspense, I'm going to propose a new name for the field, ethics. So, okay, cool. So, how do we go wrong? Let me start with how we select problems in the field. And I'm going to use for that the example of ethics and infectious disease. A few years ago, four of us published a book called The Patient as Victim and Vector, Ethics and Infectious Disease. The original idea was the brainchild of my friend and colleague, Peggy Batten. How, she asked, would bioethics have looked different if it had come into being when infectious disease had been at the forefront of pressing problems, rather than being thought of as largely a phenomenon of the past? Sometime in the late 1970s, the US Surgeon General reportedly had said, it's time to close the book on infectious disease. No one knows exactly when or where it was said. I actually tried to track it down and couldn't find it. Or even if it was said, but it's widely quoted as reflecting views of public health in the years just before the AIDS epidemic, the years when bioethics was beginning to flourish as a field. In PVV, as we called the book, we argued that infectious disease presents a kind of naturalized Rawlsian thought experiment. We're all victims and vectors to each other, interconnected in a web of actual and potential disease transmission. At any given point, we don't know where we are in the web. We might be sitting next to someone with multi-drug resistant tuberculosis. We might be staying with a friend who spent the weekend before hiking in a remote area and was exposed to hantavirus. Or we might be dragging ourselves to class, bringing along one of those little flu bugs that you see pictured here. So infectious disease reminds us that we're all in this together. We need to rethink traditional ideas such as informed consent or confidentiality, asking people to consider the impact of their decisions on others and informing them not only of the effects of their decisions on themselves, but also of the effects on others and potentially what, once again, on themselves. What goes around comes around. And we need to think about new problems, we said in PVV, planning for outbreaks, justice in primary care, forms of disease management that reduce overall transmission risks, and compensation for those in harm's way, such as first responders. As we were writing PVV, we thought the explanation was that bioethics had developed when problems of individual autonomy, like withholding or withdrawing high-tech life-sustaining treatment, were at the fore. The field, we thought, just hadn't been exposed to infectious disease. Bringing infection to the center could force a paradigm shift. I now think this analysis is not radical enough. Perhaps instead, much early work in bioethics paid attention to problems like withholding and withdrawing treatment because ethical concepts like autonomy could readily be applied to them, not because the problems themselves called out particularly for attention. After all, HIV appeared on the scene a mere 2 years after, by most reports, the Surgeon General supposedly closed the book. In 1979, although smallpox had been eradicated, polio cases numbered in the hundreds of thousands worldwide, and the World Health Organization resolution to eradicate polio did not occur until 1988. Here you see where polio was in 79 and in 1988. So the decline in polio worldwide actually came after the supposed closure of the book on infectious disease. In 1979, to the extent that malaria control was effective, it was the result of the use of pesticides, which, of course, folks in environmental ethics today still regret, like DDT. The World Health Organization had decided that eradication was not a viable strategy, and where treatment was available, it consisted primarily of fever management. The problems of infectious disease were all around. A lens of autonomy just didn't find them. And even when HIV appeared on the scene, like this, it was largely seen through autonomy. Primary attention was focused on issues like confidentiality, partner notification, demands for rapid access to therapy, and the wrongs of quarantine. Other problems, like racial disparities in access to care and support, the lack of an adequate public health infrastructure to treat sexually transmitted diseases, and even worse, mental illness, homelessness, partner abuse, or punitive immigration policies, you couldn't get into the country if you were HIV positive, were largely off the ethical radar screen, although not entirely off the legal radar screen. And their impact remains today in the differential rates of HIV. Second, top-down approaches are unidirectional. As such, they don't learn from, and they're not reshaped by, the people and the contexts to which they apply. Consider as one example the application of autonomy to people with impaired decision-making capacities who are facing difficult medical choices. On a top-down model, the starting point is an idealization of autonomy to be considered capable of making decisions on their own. Here's a slide I use sometimes in medical ethics talks. Individuals must have a basic understanding of their condition, treatment alternatives, risks and benefits. They must be able to articulate their basic values, and they must be able, in some recognizable way, to apply these values to the decisions to be made, and of course, communicate choices. If these choices don't reflect their values in some recognizable way, questions will be raised about their decision-making capacity. Healthcare providers will be advised either to seek a formal evaluation of capacity or to turn to surrogates to act for the patient. To be sure, capabilities fluctuate and healthcare providers are reminded to manage patients to maximize their involvement in decision-making. Capabilities are also a matter of degree. Some people understand, reason, and communicate better than others. So Buchanan and Brock and other scholars propose to take this into account by adjusting the requisite capacity level by such factors as the seriousness or the irrevocability of the decision at hand. Decisions on this model to withhold or withdraw life-sustaining treatment would require a more stringent capacity standard than decisions to forego a knee replacement that might improve mobility. Value structures are complicated as well. Agnieszka Jaworska, for example, argues that people with dementia may still be capable of originating critical interests if the objects of these interests are external to the person and they can still be fulfilled, and if the person maintains some sense of what is good, even without an overall narrative of his or her life. These approaches to autonomy, I've argued with Anita Silvers, apply an unduly constrained picture of decision-making to people with intellectual disabilities. They all assume that individuals understand and articulate their values on their own, an assumption that is at best partially true for most of us. Even Jaworska's article, developed importantly on the basis of her experiences as a fellow of the National Institute of Health, limits the participation of prosthetic decision makers to helping people with dementia engage in means-end reasoning and implement their choices. Instead, I think we're all on a web together, helping each other, or we should be thinking of ourselves that way. So consider by contrast the approach to legal status developed in the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, called the CRPD. This is Article 12. I don't think you can fully read it, but it's the article that establishes the right to equal recognition before the law and whatever is needed to help you realize that right. The CRPD, developed by a process that exemplifies nothing about us without us, affirms inclusion as a basic principle. Article 12 reaffirms that people with disabilities have the right to recognition as full legal persons and must enjoy legal capacity on an equal basis with others in all aspects of life. Accordingly, states parties to the CRPD must take measures to provide support for persons to exercise their legal capacity and appropriate and effective safeguards to prevent abuse. Article 12 of the CRPD has stimulated efforts in many jurisdictions to develop structures for supported decision-making, which is decision-making in which people with intellectual disabilities work with others to develop, articulate, apply, and implement their values. These efforts surely raise very complicated philosophical questions. For example, what is it for values to be authentically those of the individual? And what is exploitation, and how can we protect against it? Developing answers to these questions will also, of course, be informed by continuing work in neuroscience. My point here is not that these questions are simple, but that they're critical to understanding autonomy itself as an evolving concept and cannot be addressed without interaction with people with intellectual disabilities. How to do this is a philosophical task, not how to instruct surrogate decision makers on substituted judgment or best interest. Now, I'm not defending a strong form of standpoint theory that would reject any independent epistemological groundings or even accord persons with intellectual disabilities special authority with respect to the truth about themselves. Rather, it's the recognition that knowledge production is interpersonal and social, not entirely individual. The interpretation, application, and understanding of principles such as respect for autonomy are no exception. So a third problem, the application paradigm twists methodologies in the field. It suggests that paramount methodological problems are the selection and justification of principles, not their development, articulation, understanding, and instantiation. To illustrate this, my third critical point, I'll take two of the most famous articles from the first volume of Philosophy in Public Affairs, Judith Jarvis Thompson's Defense of Abortion and Peter Singer's Famine, Affluence, and Morality. Thompson's famous violinist, and yes, his involuntary savior, illustrate both the best and the worst of thought experiments. I expect most of you are familiar with it. You're supposed to imagine the Society of Music Lovers kidnaps you and hooks you up to the violinist in order to save his life. You only need to be hooked up for 9 months. There's no other way to keep the violinist alive, just you. Then Thompson asks, do you have to stay hooked up? Would it violate the violinist's right for you to unhook yourself and return to your ordinary life? Thompson says no, and she thinks you probably would too. This thought experiment is the centerpiece of an article with the title, A Defense of Abortion. It's deployed in an effort to show that abortion can be defended even if we grant that the fetus has a right to life. Now, the thought experiment does show, as a matter of abstract inference, that it doesn't follow from assuming that the violinist, or a fetus by analogy, has a right to life, that he has a right to the means of life. My students who oppose abortion are always happy to grant this. It doesn't follow from the right to life that you've got a right to what you need to stay alive. But what they claim is that the circumstances of the thought experiment are very different from the real world circumstances in which pregnancies occur, where people act voluntarily in various ways that incur responsibilities. Later in the article, Thompson considers some of these circumstances. When a woman voluntarily indulges in intercourse, knowing the pregnancy is a risk, or when her best efforts of protection fail, or when she acts in ways that are important to her well-being but create a risk of rape. Thompson sidesteps these cases, saying they don't show that all abortion is unjust killing. But except at their most extreme, although they seem to me to be getting more extreme every day, opponents of abortion don't claim that all abortion is unjust killing. Instead, they think that in many or perhaps even most of the cases in which people consider abortion, it's morally wrong. So how does Thompson's thought experiment misfire as an argument that might speak to those? Her title suggests that it provides a defense of abortion against its critics, but it doesn't really provide a defense against the positions of many critics. Instead, it's an analytic tool that distinguishes the abstract idea of a right from further specification of the content of the right, including whether it brings with it any claims against others. And that, as you'll see in the second half of this, is a matter of context. Or take Peter Singer's 1972 article, Famine, Affluence, and Morality. The impetus for Singer's article was the refugee crisis in East Bengal, in which he estimated that 9 million people had been displaced by poverty, a cyclone, and civil war. Coincidentally, estimates are that about 9 million people from Syria are refugees today. In Famine, Singer famously argued that how people react to such refugee situations cannot be justified, and that our moral conceptual scheme needs to be altered along with our way of life. Here's his argument in a nutshell. Suffering and death from lack of food, shelter, and medical care are bad, like this or this. If it's in our power to prevent something bad from happening without thereby sacrificing anything of comparable moral importance, we ought to do it. We ought to reach out around the world. We could prevent at least some of the refugee suffering without thereby sacrificing anything of comparable moral importance. Therefore, we ought to do what is in our power to prevent at least some of the refugee suffering. Singer admits that the prevention principle takes no account of proximity or distance, and no account of whether someone is uniquely positioned to help. Both factors that might be psychologically relevant, but he claims not morally so. This essay ushered in an entire field of global ethics, but it did so in a very peculiar way. In the absence of serious consideration of institutions or contexts, for Singer, the primary aspects of context to discuss are what others are doing or whether the aid will do any good. Government enters only as a foil to prevent, enters only as a foil to whether private charitable aid will result in a reduction of government aid. Other institutions like NGOs are absent. So is any discussion of the background of justice or injustice in the societies in question. Indeed, both Thompson's and Singer's seminal articles have these features in common. Neither takes relationships, social or political institutions from the family to the state, or background contexts of justice or injustice into account in any significant way. There are, of course, many possible explanations for this. When they wrote, the early 1970s, their roots in liberal theory and individualism. But I would suggest another. Both took principles of interest, in Thompson's case, a view about rights, and in Singer's, a form of utilitarianism, and traced out their implications for the issue at hand. Thompson doesn't consider the context in which the abortions she was discussing take place, and whether there's adequate social support for people with disabilities. And Singer never raises the issue of injustice within the societies under discussion, whether they be England or East Bengal. I should emphasize that I'm not attacking principles per se. Particularism gets it wrong, too. I agree with the late John Aris, writing on theory and bioethics in the Stanford Encyclopedia. But on the other hand, many who work in the area of bioethics, including many philosophers, are highly skeptical of the so-called applied ethics of model of moral reasoning, in which exemplars of high theory, like consequentialist utilitarianism, deontology, rights-based theories, are directly applied to practical problems. Indeed, he went on to say, most philosophically inclined contributors to the bioethics literature have eschewed high moral theory in favor of various modes of moral reasoning, falling on a spectrum between the strong particularism of various strains of casuistry or narrative ethics on the one hand, and the mid-level norms of the enormously influential principalism of Beecham and Childress on the other. Okay, so how do we get it right? We've talked about how we get it wrong in top-down selecting problems and so on. So how do we get it right? In keeping with how I approach non-ideal theorizing, I don't think we have a complete answer to how theory and practice intertwine. Rather, I think we have strategies for doing ethics better. Here I'm going to outline briefly an approach to non-ideal theory and then deploy it in two contexts: reasonable accommodation and the recognition of individual differences, and aid in dying and the recognition of context. Non-ideal theory. John Rawls famously introduced the distinction between ideal theory and partial compliance theory in A Theory of Justice. While theorizing about justice for ideal circumstances, Rawls recognized that different approaches might be needed where either natural or social circumstances were less than ideal. For my purposes here, this attention to contexts is the most important point about non-ideal theory. With respect to justice, for example, non-ideal theory treats issues such as how progress can best be made towards justice, what injustices take precedence to address, what strategies are likely to create new roadblocks to overcoming injustice, or what are the obligations of individuals or institutions when others continue to behave unjustly. Rawls didn't see the need for non-ideal theory as a problem about ideals, but as about whether real-world circumstances were such that ideals could reasonably be applied to them. Subsequently, discussions of non-ideal and partial compliance theory have mushroomed. But these discussions, too, largely see the problems as lying with existing circumstances, not with the construction of ideals. For example, Sophia Stemplowska, in What's Ideal About Ideal Theory, sees ideal theory as theory that fails to issue recommendations for how to improve our society that are applicable for us here and now. She thinks theories that assume full compliance and thus are inapplicable to present circumstances can still be useful because they provide a standard against which to judge comparatively whether we are taking steps towards the ideal and to have a picture of what an ideal might look like. You could think of this as the road to the ideal view. Here I side with Amartya Sen in emphasizing the importance of comparative rather than transcendental theories of justice. Sen argues that theories of justice need not take a complete or totalist form for many reasons, including information gaps, difficulties in judging among considerations with a dimension of weight, or the need to make political room for agreement among different points of view. A major driver of Sen's approach is his view about the limits of social choice and the ability of decision procedures to yield partial but incomplete agreement. My starting places are somewhat different. As I see justice, it's a matter of ongoing work at inclusion and flourishing, asking what next steps at individual or social levels will enable individuals in all their differences to do well at what matters to them. In my view, a picture of ideal justice might be so abstract as to be vacuous, so fuzzy as to be unrecognizable, or perhaps even positively misleading. The same is true about idealizations of autonomy. In discussing how comparative justice might work, Sen gives the example of the United States providing more universal health insurance, but remaining a society in many respects unjust. I would develop this example by arguing that the US is a more just society if it includes more people receiving funding for healthcare appropriate to their conditions and choices when others are already receiving similar care, without having a complete picture of what a fully just healthcare system would look like. Indeed, given developing technology, changing understandings of the nature of disease, the ever-shifting world of disease itself, and conflicting demands on social resources, we may not be able to say what a fully just healthcare system might look like. Now, idealization might tempt us to say it would be a system in which everybody got all of the needed healthcare possible under the circumstances. But that might be vacuous. What is this greatest amount? Or, more disturbing, it might lead us into a situation not so unrecognizably like what we face today, wherein everyone might think that getting more health care for themselves is a matter of urgent justice, when it might not be comparatively more just at all. In her critical review of Sen, Frances Cam quite rightly observes that correcting one injustice, those left out of healthcare, might create others, as Oregon attempted to implement limits on some forms of care in order to expand its Medicaid program. She is, of course, right. Non-ideal theory is messy in this way, but it doesn't follow that we need an ideal of full inclusion to decide which is the preferable injustice. Rather, we need to keep challenging, evaluating, and reevaluating the exclusionary effects of policy changes like the rationing scheme Oregon once introduced. Individual differences in accommodations is my first example. Since enactment of the Americans with Disabilities Act in 1990, and the Rehab Act before it in 1973, US law has developed an extensive jurisprudence of reasonable accommodations. The ADA employment provision states that it is discrimination to fail to make reasonable accommodations to the known physical or mental limitations of an otherwise qualified individual with a disability who is an applicant or an employee, unless such covered entity can demonstrate that the accommodation would impose an undue hardship on the operation of the business of such covered entity. Critics of the ADA claim that the reasonable accommodation requirement is not a civil right, but a special privilege that benefits people with disabilities at the expense of other employees and imposes significant costs that can't be justified on employers more generally. Assessing this claim requires attention to individual differences and their significance. Many factors affect workplace design: history, convenience, social convention, efficiency, costs, and inertia, among others. Often these factors are unrelated to the goals of jobs, skills needed to perform them, or modes of performance. Working in a room that is accessible only by climbing stairs, wearing robes, sitting for long periods of time, or being elevated on a high bench are not relevant to judging, for example. Nor does impartiality require that oral arguments take exactly 1 hour without breaks, that case materials be filed in a format that is, in practice, inaccessible to people with visual impairments, or that communication access real-time translation, or CART, which you see over there, be the only technology provided for people with hearing impairments in court, as the common portrayal of justice as masked or blind reminds. Of course, changes in longstanding practices may be inconvenient or expensive, but this is a different question than whether actual or potential employees are capable of performing essential job functions. There may, of course, be disputes about which functions are essential or whether alternative methods of performance are effective. But as Anita Silvers and I, and two other co-authors, argued in Accommodating Everybody, accommodations are reasonable when they enable work-capable people to perform jobs successfully. Their costliness is a further question. If workplaces have been designed in ways that make it easier for typical people to perform, it may be fairer to share redesign costs socially rather than letting them fall on particular employers, particularly small employers. But the alternative, maintaining the workplace status quo as the presumptively acceptable state of affairs, would continue to effectively exclude otherwise capable individuals and thus should not be taken as the default position against which to evaluate all change. Now, I want to compare this jurisprudence of accommodation against another policy area where accommodation has also played a major role, religion. The connection between non-discrimination and accommodation actually first came into U.S. law in the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which defined religion for anti-discrimination purposes to include an accommodation requirement. Here's the text of the statute. The primary understanding of this accommodation requirement was that employers should be flexible about scheduling, shift assignments, or dress requirements that might interfere with individuals' practice of their religions. Here, as later with disability accommodation, the goal was shaping the workplace to allow capable individuals with differing religious commitments to perform their jobs successfully. Now, more recently, employers have also claimed accommodation rights with respect to obligations to provide contraceptive coverage under the Affordable Care Act, claims that I think may impede rather than recognizing difference. Their argument is that filing a form to claim a religious exemption violates their free exercise of religion under statutory and constitutional law. The Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals determined that this notice requirement did not unduly burden religious liberty because the employers are not required to provide coverage or bear any costs with respect to coverage. They're not penalized for failing to provide coverage, and they're not themselves required to do anything with respect to coverage other than giving notice. In other words, all the employer needs to do is self-affirm that its religious beliefs prohibit the coverage. Hardly a requirement that excludes people with religious beliefs who are opposed to contraception. Indeed, what it would seem to do is exclude employees who do not share their employer's beliefs and who wish to use contraception. Okay, second example. Consider aid in dying and the importance of context. Legalization of aid in dying in the United States is a continuing goal of defenders of patient autonomy. At present, aid in dying is legally permitted in 5 states, Vermont, Montana, California, Oregon, and Washington, and active campaigns for legalization are underway in more than 20 others. The primary argument for aid in dying is autonomy. In the words of Compassion and Choices, everyone who believes in end-of-life options owes a debt of gratitude to Brittany Maynard. Now, just how the availability of aid in dying enhances autonomy is not fully specified, however, and context matters. Aid in dying does add an option not otherwise available, but merely adding an option doesn't necessarily advance autonomy. Whether autonomy is advanced depends on what choices are made effectively available and the importance of these choices to the individuals who make them. Clearly, people who seek aid in dying over other alternatives want it very strongly indeed, but the strength of a desire is also insufficient to show that means to its fulfillment enhances autonomy. There are reasons beyond intensity of desire to think that the option of aid in dying is important. It furthers experiential interests in being free from pain and other forms of distress, in not anticipating pain or distress, and what Dworkin called critical interests in living out one's last days on one's own terms and in being remembered as one was before the final days of illness took their toll. In the words of Gawande, spending your final days in an ICU is for most people a kind of failure. You rely on a ventilator, your every organ shutting down, your mind teetering on delirium and permanently beyond realizing that you will never leave this borrowed fluorescent place. Contemporary forms of palliative sedation, coupled with the surety that it will be readily available when needed, can largely obviate the need for aid in dying to address experiential interests. It's unclear how aid in dying will do better than planned sedation in enabling meaningful closure with others. No matter how available or well managed, however, palliative sedation will not address some critical interests that remain: the ability to choose how one dies and how one's loved ones remember one's last days. Context can help with this too, with support, comfortable surroundings, a kind of pre-death lying in state, but it can't address these issues fully. What it leaves is the question of how important the choice of the manner of the last few days really is. Simplistic arguments from autonomy don't capture these nuances. Now, there's another aspect of the context advanced by disability activists opposed to aid in dying. These critics are concerned that some will choose aid in dying out of coercion, a concern not borne out by the data. Critics also contend that legalization of aid in dying expresses or reflects erroneous views about the quality of life of people with disabilities. This too fails to recognize that aid in dying is being defended only as a matter of choice, not as a matter of what would be in the best interests of people who are terminally ill or what their quality of life might be. A better contextual argument advanced by its opponents is that aid in dying is problematic when people lack adequate access to pain management or support for care at home or other services like vocational rehabilitation. Actually, in the Netherlands, there's universal health care. There's an act that covers additional costs for long-term chronic illness with the goal of helping people live at home for as long as possible. You can get nursing care, personal care, domestic help, and sheltered accommodation. In comparison, the U.S. offers far less. All of the states in which aid in dying is currently legal have expanded Medicaid. But there are now 8 states with pending aid in dying bills that have not expanded their state's Medicaid. Just to give you a little data, states with aid in dying currently have a 10.5 4% average of uninsured, with a range from 7% to 15%. But with the states now thinking about it, the comparable numbers are 12.9%, with a high of 18%. As for home health, California covers unlimited amounts for some categories, and Washington covers 2 visits a day, but other states offer far more limited benefits and for far fewer people. These are essential services for people to be able to live in their communities. My point here is not that we must always choose access to health care over aid in dying, or even that we must choose between the two. Rather, it's that if we understand the contexts in which these policies are defended, we can see what each might actually do with respect to autonomy in different circumstances. We can see more specifically both how aid in dying might expand autonomy and why people with disabilities might think that advocacy for Medicaid or home health is far more important politically. So a couple of concluding words. You may have guessed that I'm a pragmatist methodologically. To that, I plead guilty. I think ethics could learn a lot from the pragmatist tradition. And one of the most important things it could learn is to object to artificial separations between ethics and its application. Thank you all very much.